Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief, brought to you by Spoken Layer. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. A Complete History of Aziz Ansari's Obsession with Food by Mahida Gajanan. Aziz Ansari's affinity for food has become an intractable part of the actor and comedian's identity. The release of the second season of Ansari's Netflix show Master of None on May 12th takes his food obsession to new heights. In the new season, Ansari's character Dev travels to Italy to pursue his greatest love, pasta. And much like in its first season, the series again pays homage to New York City's food scene, with many of its pivotal moments taking place in restaurants and bars throughout the city. With celebrity chefs like David Chang among his friends, a lesson in Italian cooking with Mario Batali under his belt, and countless posts of food porn dotting his Instagram, Ansari has established himself as a food connoisseur. Just don't call him a foodie. Here's a look at Ansari's long-standing relationship with food. The time he joked about fried chicken as an antidote to racism. It's safe to say that Ansari's love of food blossomed during his childhood in South Carolina. In his 2012 stand-up special, Dangerously Delicious, he notes that although growing up in a conservative state as the child of Indian Muslims had its difficult moments, there was a bright side, Southern food. Growing up in South Carolina is kind of like, oh, did that guy just say the N-word? Ooh, fried chicken and biscuits. Never mind, he quips. The time he failed to hide his bacon habit from his parents. Unlike his parents, who don't eat pork for religious reasons, Ansari quite enjoys the very tasty meat, he told Conan O'Brien in 2015. Although he avoids eating pork in front of his parents, Ansari slipped up a few times when his parents visited him for 2 weeks, including the bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich with which they caught him red-handed when he ran into them on the street. He lovingly blamed his transgressions on his then-girlfriend. The time his love for food got him a ticket to Tokyo. In 2011, famous at the time for his stand-up work and role in Parks and Recreation, Ansari joined Chang and LCD Sound System's James Murphy for a rollicking journey through Tokyo as part of a GQ feature. The three ate their way through the city, and Ansari was observed going into sensory deprivation mode whenever he ate anything especially delicious. The time he fell in love over cookies. For 2 years, the comedian dated chef Courtney McBroom, who told Food & Wine in 2015 that they met at Momofuku Milk Bar in Manhattan and later bonded over a treat called a Hokey Pokey Cookie. The couple has since broken up. The time he admitted to being a total food nerd. Ansari revealed many of his innermost thoughts on food in a recent 73 questions interview with Vogue. Among them, he wants to learn to cook everything, can say I'm hungry in 6 languages, loves all sorts of tacos, and thinks people who don't care what they eat should be called food bozos. The time his Parks and Recreation character nicknamed every type of food. As Tom Haverford on Parks and Recreation, Ansari played a small-town guy with dreams so big he wears red carpet on the inside of his shoes. Tom's taste for the finer things inspires him to devise special names for his favorite foods, including Fry Fry Chicky Chick for fried chicken and Super Water for root beer. The time his Master of None character chose pasta over his girlfriend. Pasta comes up frequently in Master of None. In the first season, Dev avoids using a pasta maker gifted to him by his girlfriend out of fear that he's not a good enough cook. Eating pasta, however, is not a problem. I'm a man of many interests, but my true passion might be pasta, Dev tells his girlfriend's grandmother in one episode. After breaking up with his girlfriend at the end of season one, Dev looks to pasta to mend his broken heart with a trip to Italy. The time his Master of None character learned to make tortellini like an Italian grandmother. Dev will no longer need his pasta maker after spending time learning how to do it by hand with a pasta-making grandma in Modena in season 2 of Master of None. Ansari's real-life trip to Italy to film the show meant eating tons of pasta, of course, along with several other Italian delicacies. Unpublished photos capture the life-saving role of nurses in World War II by Lily Rothman and Liz Ronk. When nurses and their grateful patients around the world mark International Nurses Day on Friday, they will also be marking the anniversary of Florence Nightingale's birth on May 12, 1820. Though nursing has always been an important profession, the story of Florence Nightingale, who achieved renown as a nurse during the Crimean War, is a good reminder that it's often during times of war that the invaluable role of the nurse is most obvious. In early 1942, when Life magazine featured the need for nurses as its cover story, that fact was as crystal clear. Most of the photos were taken for that story but went unpublished. In the wake of the December 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor, the U.S. nurse shortage had been thrown into sharp relief. The Army and Navy together were enlisting 15,000 nurses. The U.S. Public Health Service said it needed 10,000 nurses too, and U.S. civilian hospitals were already operating at nurse staffing levels that were 10% short of what they needed. With about 23,000 new nurses graduating from existing training programs each year, the need could not be met fast enough for wartime. In light of that situation, the Office of Civilian Defense and the Red Cross joined together to call for 100,000 American women, they were all women at the time, to volunteer as unpaid wartime nurses' aides working under the supervision of registered nurses. By performing duties like feeding patients and taking temperatures, they would thus free up the registered nurses to perform the jobs that required the most training or to go to war. It was an idea that had come about during World War I, and the U.S. entry into World War II had created a renewed need for their services. Meanwhile, the Army and Navy clearly knew just how important those nurses were. Registered nurses, the magazine noted, were superior to enlisted men in Army and Navy hospitals, as they were commissioned officers. Like other officers, the story explained, nurses of the U.S. Army and Navy Nurse Corps have not only their own jobs to do, but they must also teach enlisted men to do theirs. The idea was that, though nurses often came within battle range in field hospitals and aboard ships, the men who were taught by the nurses could provide battlefield first aid. In a parallel concept, the nurses' aides were expected to put what they learned to use after the war in homes across the nation, helping keep American families safe and healthy in peacetime. But if something did go wrong at home, they would also be able to put to use one particular piece of knowledge that they'd have learned during the war, that if you did need to go to the hospital, you were in good hands with a well-trained nurse. How I Overcame the Heartbreak of My Son's Autism Diagnosis by Areva Martin. For all of us, there are times when the spinning wheel of fortune lands on bad things. We face tragedy, heartbreak, loss, rejection, disappointment, challenges the likes of which we never faced before. Somehow, we not only survive these challenges, but also come out stronger and wiser. If we take a moment to reflect, we know that everything we are, all the love, strength, and resilience that we have inside, we got from our mothers. Though mothers may have perfect love for their children, we are far from perfect ourselves. We suffer from the same human frailties as everyone else, and when fate deals us a seemingly bad hand, we can, just like anyone else, reach a breaking point. We can lose our composure, our supermom capes, and become vulnerable, questioning everyone and everything around us. I should know, because it happened to me. Early in my legal career, my third child, Marty, was diagnosed with autism. I was absolutely devastated. Like most parents, I dreamed of a life of endless possibilities for my son. Maybe he'd become the CEO of a Fortune 500 company or a distinguished archaeology professor, gallivanting around the globe like Indiana Jones, or perhaps he'd even become President of the United States. But with an autism diagnosis, I had to question whether the grand dreams I had for my son were still a possibility. Without doubt, his life was going to be very different from the one I'd imagined. With that brutal knowledge, I went into a deep depression to the point where I couldn't even say the word autism without crying uncontrollably. I spiraled downward into a world of doubt and self-pity, constantly asking questions like, why did this happen to me? What did I do wrong? Did I work too many hours? Did I eat the wrong foods during my pregnancy? What on earth did I do to deserve to have my perfect world rocked? For a time, I didn't know how I would carry on. I went to bed early and slept late, oblivious to the world around me. Then, one day, it came to me. From the recesses of my mind, from the early days of my childhood, I remembered the profound words of my mother, "Don't question, persevere." I remembered hearing those words over and over again, every time I thought I was being treated unfairly. Why did some kids get to live in big houses and ride in fancy cars while I lived in the projects? Don't question, persevere. Why did some kids have shiny new bikes and Barbie dolls when I didn't? Don't question, persevere. So, with Marty's diagnosis, I stopped questioning. Instead, I persevered. I determined that I was going to make the best life possible for my son, no matter what. I educated myself on all there was to know about autism, and I went on a quest to find Marty the best care possible. And what I realized in talking with healthcare professionals and talking to parents of children with autism was that there was much to be hopeful about. That with early intervention therapies, the appropriate educational setting, and lots of love and support, Marty, like other kids on the autism spectrum, could thrive. My mother's admonition to persevere led me from anguish to advocacy, not just for Marty, but also for millions of other kids on the spectrum through my nonprofit work with Special Needs Network and other autism advocacy organizations. Looking back, I realized how self-absorbed I was. I didn't see that what was handed to me was the most wonderful gift, the most fantastic blessing a mother could ask for. Today, my son Marty is a handsome teenager who is leading a full and productive life. I couldn't love him more or be prouder of the person he's become. As I reflect on Mother's Day, I'm reminded of the following words from author Gail Tsukiyama. Mothers and their children are in a category all their own. There's no bond so strong in the entire world, no love so instantaneous and forgiving. Any woman who's given birth to a child on the autism spectrum, who's fed them, changed their diapers, bathed them, taught them right from wrong, and loved them unconditionally through thick and thin, knows exactly what those words mean. Areva Martin is an attorney, advocate, television host, legal and social issues commentator, and author. She is the founder of Martin and Martin LLP, and her next book, Make It Rain, will be published by Hachette in 2018. New college grads could be looking at the highest starting salaries ever, by Brad Tuttle. Congratulations, class of 2017. You just might have a prayer of paying off your student loans. A study released this week by the Hay Group division of the executive search firm Korn Ferry reports that average starting pay for new college grads has never been higher than it is right now. The average starting salary for a 2017 college grad is just a smidge under $50,000, $49,785 to be exact, the study indicates. That's up 3% from last year. After adjusting for inflation, the average pay for new college grads is 14% higher than it was for the graduating class of 2007, before the Great Recession decimated earnings for many categories of workers. While there are different ways of measuring pay, Korn Ferry stated that average salaries for 2017 grads are at an all-time high. Researchers gathered the data by analyzing the entry-level salaries of 145,000 positions from 700 companies and organizations around the country. Not all career fields are represented, however. The study is instead presented as a snapshot report of 25 jobs. As you'd imagine, jobs in the STEM, science, tech, engineering, math fields have starting salaries that are well above average. The job in Korn Ferry's study with the highest average pay for new grads is software developer, $65,232, followed by engineer, $63,036, and actuary, $59,212. Down at the low end of the study's pay spectrum are customer service representatives, $35,848, and assistants, $35,592. But are 2017's salaries for new grads really at an all-time high? Maybe not. The study appears to only include 10 years' worth of data, and the Wall Street Journal's coverage stated only that pay is at its highest in at least a decade. Last summer, the National Association of Colleges and Employers, NACE, released a more comprehensive study looking at new college grad pay from 1960 to 2015, and researchers adjusted the salaries for inflation to see when they were truly highest and lowest. Somewhat surprisingly, the overall adjusted average salary hit its lowest point in 1995, NACE found, when the average new grad earned only $29,276, or $45,202 after adjusting for inflation. By contrast, in 1969, the adjusted average salary for new grads was measured at $59,169. That's significantly higher than the 2017 new grad numbers cited by Korn Ferry, of course. Research from NACE indicates that new grad salaries hovered around $53,000 after adjusting for inflation from 2008 to 2011, before dipping down into the $45,000s in 2012 and 2013, and then rebounding to $50,219 in 2015 and an estimated $50,556 in 2016. So the data from different studies is obviously not consistent, and today's grads may not actually be earning the highest inflation-adjusted salaries ever. Still, one thing is quite clear, and it's good news for young college grads. Starting pay is trending up.
The Surprisingly Sad Origins of Mother's Day by Olivia B. Waxman. Perhaps it's appropriate that the day on which Americans celebrate mothers has an odd set of parents. President Woodrow Wilson is usually seen as the father of Mother's Day for signing a proclamation on May 9, 1914, declaring the second Sunday of May a public expression of our love and reverence for the mothers of our country. While copywriter Anna Jarvis is usually seen as the mother of Mother's Day for creating the movement that led to the proclamation. It was on May 10, 1908, that Jarvis sent 500 white carnations to Andrews Methodist Episcopal Church in her hometown of Grafton, West Virginia, in honor of her late mother, Anne. That date, on which she also held a celebration in Philadelphia, where she lived at the time, is considered to be America's first Mother's Day celebration. In 2017, Mother's Day will be marked on Sunday, May 14th. But Jarvis wasn't the only person to try to start a holiday dedicated to mothers. One notable person who might also have a claim to that fame, Jarvis's own mother, had come up with such an idea in the mid-19th century. Her vision for Mother's Day, however, looked very different from the gift-centric holiday of modern times. It's not that Anna Jarvis concealed the fact that she got the idea from her mother as she spread the word about the holiday. She always traced it back to the moment when, in 1876, she heard her mother recite the following prayer after teaching a Sunday school lesson. I hope and pray that someone, sometime, will found a memorial Mother's Day commemorating her for the matchless service she renders to humanity in every field of life. When her mother died in 1905, she vowed to fulfill that dream. But what the elder Jarvis probably had in mind was something different than what her daughter eventually brought to reality. Evidence suggests that the original idea was for a Mother's Day, a day for mothers, plural, not a day for one's own mother, on which mothers would get together for a day of service to help out other mothers who were less fortunate than they were, according to Catherine Lane Antolini, an assistant professor of history and gender studies at West Virginia Wesleyan College and author of Memorializing Motherhood, Anna Jarvis and the Struggle for the Control of Mother's Day. Why would the elder Jarvis have focused her idea for the commemoration of motherhood on this idea of community service? The reason was a tragic one. Her experience of motherhood had been infused with sadness. Of the 13 children that she bore, only 4 lived to adulthood. Her story was not uncommon. An estimated 15% to 30% of infants in that Appalachian region died before their first birthday throughout the 19th and early 20th century, largely due to epidemics that were spread by poor sanitary conditions, according to Antolini's book. In 1858, while she was pregnant for the 6th time, Jarvis enlisted the help of her brother, Dr. James Reeves, who was involved in treating victims of the typhoid fever epidemic to try and improve the situation. They organized events at which doctors were invited to lead discussions with local mothers on the latest hygiene practices that could keep their children healthy. They called the events Mother's Day Work Clubs. But when it came time for Jarvis to lead the charge for a National Day for Mothers, she left behind that idea of educating mothers. Perhaps it was because she was not a mother herself, Antolini suggests, and thus she couldn't be a leader for a holiday that encourages mothers to be socially active. In addition, she may have thought a more uplifting tone would be easier to market broadly. She didn't want it to be turned into a beggar's day, says Antolini. She thought even poor mothers were rich if they had their kids' love. As the popularity of the holiday spread, several other people came forward to claim they had been the first to start celebrating mothers. For example, around the same time Anna Jarvis started Mother's Day work clubs to stop babies from dying prematurely, Battle Hymn of the Republic writer Julia Ward Howe had started a Mother's Peace Day, inspired by the Civil War and subsequent Franco-Prussian War, on which mothers supported anti-war efforts so that their sons wouldn't die prematurely. And city leaders of Henderson, Kentucky, argued that Mary Towles Sassine should get credit for starting a day to honor mothers all the way back in 1887, at which point Sassine was a 24-year-old school principal. She would even curate a book of songs, poems, and readings for schools that wanted to organize tributes to mothers. And if you ask the Fraternal Order of Eagles, the organization would say Mother's Day started in 1904 with its member, Frank Herring, a football coach and Notre Dame faculty member who required students to write a note to their mothers once a month. Antolini notes that some historians also point out the paradoxical timing of Jarvis's version of Mother's Day taking hold at the beginning of the 20th century. People had been talking about the idea for decades, but the holiday got national attention just at a time when more women were beginning to get jobs outside the home, and some experts see the embrace of a celebration of motherhood as a backlash against that change. In any case, when it came to championing the idea, Jarvis proved that she definitely deserved the credit. Her advertising background probably helped, Antolini argues. By 1912, she had quit her job in the industry and started Mother's Day International Association. Partnerships with florists and a successful letter-writing campaign to state governors helped the holiday get recognized at the state and eventually federal level. And for someone who started such a happy day, her life ended in a sad way. Her Mother's Day campaign was funded primarily by her inheritance, and she came to resent the fact that florists and candy makers were making lots of money from the idea without crediting her. Jarvis came to feel that the day was being used as a means of profiteering, as the New York Times reported on May 18, 1923. Antolini believes that fighting with other people for full credit for starting Mother's Day was a key factor in Jarvis eventually ending up broke, blind, and in a sanitarium. She died in 1948 and was buried next to her mother. Read by Lynn Foley. To all moms out there, happy Mother's Day.
Nations Grapple with Global Ransomware Cyberattack, by Sylvia Hui and Jim Heinz, AP, London. A global cyber attack unprecedented in scale had technicians scrambling to restore Britain's crippled hospital network Saturday and secure the computers that run factories, banks, government agencies, and transport systems in many other nations. The worldwide cyber extortion attack is so unprecedented, in fact, that Microsoft quickly changed its policy, announcing security fixes available for free for the older Windows systems still used by millions of individuals and smaller businesses. After an emergency government meeting Saturday in London, Britain's Home Secretary said 1 in 5 of 248 National Health Service groups had been hit. The onslaught forced hospitals to cancel or delay treatments for thousands of patients, even some with serious ailments like cancer. Home Secretary Amber Rudd said 48 NHS trusts were affected, and all but 6 were now back to normal. The UK's National Cybersecurity Centre said it is working round the clock to restore vital health services. Security officials in Britain urged organizations to protect themselves by updating their security software fixes, running antivirus software, and backing up data elsewhere. Who perpetrated this wave of attacks remains unknown. Two security firms, Kaspersky Lab and Avast, said they identified the malicious software in more than 70 countries. Both said Russia was hit hardest. And all this may be just a taste of what's coming, a cybersecurity expert warned. Computer users worldwide, and everyone else who depends on them, should assume that the next big ransomware attack has already been launched and just hasn't manifested itself yet. Ori Eisen, who founded the Trusana cybersecurity firm in Scottsdale, Arizona, told the Associated Press. The attack held hospitals and other entities hostage by freezing computers, encrypting data, and demanding money through online Bitcoin payments. But it appears to be low-level stuff, given the amounts of ransom demanded, Eisen said Saturday. He said the same thing could be done to crucial infrastructure like nuclear power plants, dams, or railway systems. This is child's play, what happened. This is not the serious stuff yet. What if the same thing happened to 10 nuclear power plants, and they would shut down all the electricity to the grid? What if the same exact thing happened to a water dam or to a bridge, he asked. Today it happened to 10,000 computers, Eisen said. There's no barrier to do it tomorrow to 100 million computers. This is already believed to be the biggest online extortion attack ever recorded, disrupting services in nations as diverse as the U.S., Russia, Ukraine, Spain, and India. Europol, the European Union's police agency, said the onslaught was at an unprecedented level and will require a complex international investigation to identify the culprits. The ransomware appeared to exploit a vulnerability in Microsoft Windows that was purportedly identified by the U.S. National Security Agency for its own intelligence-gathering purposes. The NSA tools were stolen by hackers and dumped on the Internet. A young cybersecurity researcher has been credited with helping to halt the ransomware spread by accidentally activating a so-called kill switch in the malicious software. The Guardian newspaper reported Saturday that the 22-year-old Britain-based researcher, identified online only as Malware Tech, found that the software spread could be stopped by registering a garbled domain name. It said his $11 purchase of the name on Friday may have saved governments and companies around the world millions, slowing its spread before U.S.-based computers were hit on a massive scale. In the U.S., FedEx Corporation reported that its Windows computers were experiencing interference from malware, but wouldn't say if it had been hit by ransomware. Other impacts in the U.S. were not readily apparent on Saturday. The kill switch couldn't help those already infected, however. Short of paying, options for these individuals and companies are to recover data files from a backup, if available, or to live without them. Before Friday's attack, Microsoft had made fixes for older systems, such as 2001's Windows XP, available only to mostly larger organizations that paid extra for extended technical support. Microsoft says now it will make the fixes free for everyone. Russian agencies slowly acknowledged that they were affected, but insisted that all attacks had been resolved. The Russian Interior Ministry, which runs the country's police, confirmed it fell victim. Ministry spokeswoman Irina Volk was quoted by the Interfax news agency Saturday as saying the problem had been localized with no information compromised. A spokesman for the Russian Health Ministry, Nikita Odintsov, tweeted that the cyber attacks on his ministry were effectively repelled. When we say that the health ministry was attacked, you should understand that it wasn't the main server, it was local computers. Actually, nothing serious or deadly happened yet, German Klimenko, a presidential advisor, said on Russian state television. Russian cellular phone operators, Megafon and MTS, were among those hit. Russia's national railway system said it was attacked, but rail operations were unaffected. Russia's central bank said Saturday that no incidents were compromising the data resources of Russian banks. French car maker Renault's assembly plant in Slovenia halted production after it was targeted. Radio Slovenia said Saturday the Revoz factory in the southeastern town of Novo Mesto stopped working Friday evening to stop the malware from spreading. Krishna Chinthapalli, a doctor at Britain's National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery, who wrote a paper on cybersecurity for the British Medical Journal, said many British hospitals still use Windows XP software, introduced in 2001. Security experts said it appeared to be caused by a self-replicating piece of software that enters companies when employees click on email attachments, then spreads quickly as employees share documents. The security holes it exploits were disclosed weeks ago by the Shadow Brokers, a mysterious group that published what it said are hacking tools used by the NSA. Microsoft swiftly announced that it had already issued software patches to fix those holes, but many users haven't yet installed updates or still use older versions of Windows. Elsewhere in Europe, the attack hit companies including Spain's Telefonica, a global broadband and telecommunications company. Germany's National Railway said Saturday departure and arrival display screens at its train stations were affected, but there was no impact on actual train services. Deutsche Bahn said it had deployed extra staff to help customers. Other European organizations hit by the massive cyber attack included some soccer clubs. IF Odd, a 132-year-old Norwegian soccer club, said its online ticketing facility was down. Donald Trump urges Liberty University grads to stand up to criticism in commencement speech. By Darlene Superville, AP. Lynchburg, Virginia. Delivering his first commencement address, President Donald Trump on Saturday urged graduates of a Christian university to follow their convictions, but to also be willing to stand up to criticism from others who don't have the courage to do what is right. Trump kept to an upbeat message in his first extended public appearance since firing James Comey as FBI director this week, saying the lawyer and veteran prosecutor was an incompetent showboat and grandstander. The timing of Comey's dismissal raised questions about Trump's decision as the FBI continues its investigation into Russia's role in the 2016 presidential campaign that ended with Trump's election. Trump didn't mention the fallout over Comey's firing in his remarks to graduates of Liberty University, a Christian school whose leader was one of Trump's earliest and most outspoken supporters during the campaign. Drawing parallels to what was widely viewed as a long-shot bid by Trump for the presidency, he urged the more than 18,000 graduates to fight for what they believe in and to challenge entrenched interests and failed power structures. A crowd of more than double that size filled an outdoor stadium on campus to welcome just the second sitting president to address the university's commencement. "Remember this, nothing worth doing ever, ever, ever came easy," Trump said. "Following your convictions means you must be willing to face criticism from those who lack the same courage to do what is right. And they know what is right, but they don't have the courage or the guts or the stamina to take it and to do it." Trump told graduates to treat the word impossible as nothing more than motivation and to embrace being called an outsider because it's the outsiders who change the world. The more that a broken system tells you that you're wrong, the more certain you must be that you must keep pushing ahead, added Trump, who often complains about being underestimated during the presidential campaign. Trump, who took office on January 20th, also sounded familiar campaign themes about a broken system in Washington. "In my short time in Washington, I've seen firsthand how the system is broken," he said. "A small group of failed voices who think they know everything and understand everyone want to tell everyone else what to do and how to live and what to think. But you aren't going to let other people tell you what to believe, especially when you know that you're right. We don't need a lecture from Washington, D.C. on how to lead our lives, Trump said. Jerry Falwell, Jr., Liberty's president, helped Trump win an overwhelming 80% of the white evangelical vote. A recent Pew Research Center survey marking Trump's first 100 days in office, a milestone reached on April 29th, found three-quarters of white evangelicals approved of his performance as president, while just 39% of the general public held the same view. Christian conservatives have been overjoyed by Trump's appointment of Justice Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, along with Trump's choice of socially conservative cabinet members and other officials, such as Charmaine Yost, a prominent anti-abortion activist named to the Department of Health and Human Services. But they had a mixed response to an executive order on religious liberty that Trump signed last week. He directed the IRS to ease up on enforcing an already rarely enforced limit on partisan political activity by churches. He also promised regulatory relief for those who object on religious grounds to the birth control coverage requirement in the Affordable Care Act health law. Yet the order did not address one of the most pressing demands from religious conservatives, broad exemptions from recognizing same-sex marriage. Still, Falwell, who endorsed Trump in January 2016, just before that year's Iowa caucuses, praised Trump's actions on issues that concern Christian conservatives. I really don't think any other president has done more for evangelicals and the faith community in 4 months than President Trump has, Falwell told the Associated Press in a telephone interview on Friday. Falwell became a key surrogate and validator for the thrice-married Trump during the campaign, frequently traveling with Trump on the candidate's plane and appearing at events. Falwell often compared Trump to his late father, the conservative televangelist Jerry Falwell, and argued that while Trump wasn't the most religious candidate in the race, he was the man the country needed. Trump has spoken at Liberty University before. He courted Christians there in January 2016 with a speech that drew laughs from some in the audience when he referred to one of the Bible's books as 2 Corinthians instead of the more common 2 Corinthians. In that speech, Trump promised, "We're going to protect Christianity, and I can say that. I don't have to be politically correct."
Malala Yousafzai, refugee girls across the world remain hopeful. Malala Yousafzai is an education activist from Pakistan. On May 13th, Yousafzai will become one of 5 recipients of the 2017 International Ellis Island Medal of Honor from the National Ethnic Coalition of Organizations. NECO writes that the award is meant to recognize individuals who have made it their mission to share with those less fortunate their wealth of knowledge, indomitable courage, boundless compassion, unique talents, and selfless generosity, all while maintaining the traditions of their ethnic heritage as they uphold the ideals and spirit of America. While Yousafzai will not be able to attend the ceremony, she wrote this letter to the coalition and its chairman, Nasser J. Kazemini. "Dear Mr. Kazemini and the National Ethnic Coalition of Organizations, thank you for honoring me with the prestigious 2017 International Ellis Island Medal of Honor Award. I'm sorry I cannot be with you for your ceremony, but I am still in secondary school and preparing for my final exams. However, even from thousands of miles away, I am proud to be in the company of my fellow 2017 recipients whose achievements as innovators and humanitarians are incredible gifts to the United States and our world. Ellis Island was known as an island of hope for the thousands of immigrants and refugees who journeyed to America for a chance at a new life. Today, it stands as a reminder of a spirit of welcome for people in need, as well as the contributions of generations of immigrants and refugees. I wholeheartedly applaud NECO for its work to uphold those values. Today, millions of girls in refugee camps and conflict zones have lost their homes, friends, families, and are unable to go to school. Yet, despite these isolating challenges, the girls I've met remain hopeful that their futures will be brighter. They are waiting to be accepted into their own island of hope, whether that's in the United States, Jordan, the United Kingdom, Greece, or any other nation offering shelter and a chance to learn. Through my work at Malala Fund, I stand committed to fighting for the rights of refugees and for a world where every girl has equal access to 12 years of free, safe, quality education. And now more than ever, we must remain steadfast in our efforts. The spirit of empathy that NECO embodies is one I hope countries around the world will emulate when responding to the refugee crisis. Together, we can be a powerful force for change. Thank you again for this remarkable honor. Sincerely, Malala Yousafzai. Howard University sued for allegedly failing to act promptly on sexual assault reports by the Associated Press, Washington. Five current and former Howard University students are alleging in a federal lawsuit that the school didn't respond quickly and equitably to female students' sexual assault reports. News outlets report that in the suit filed Wednesday, plaintiffs accuse the historically black college in Washington of discriminatory and retaliatory response to multiple complaints of sexual assault and harassment. According to the lawsuit, one woman reported to a school official that a male student raped her last year. She later connected with a second woman who said she reported that the same person raped her in 2015. No arrests have been made in either case. Howard said in a statement that it takes such allegations very seriously, but it doesn't comment on pending litigation. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.